this is Angela Davis. You're listening to CKUT 90.3.
Angela, you're one of a million of political prisoners in the world.
Pandemic, the health anxiety, the lockdowns and isolation associated with it has a lot of people feeling a bit behind in things like social skills and academics. We're all in this together. I know we all have different experiences and we have different experiences of being in this together, but in terms of feeling like there was some time where we weren't attending classes or we weren't seeing people, a lot of people have that as a shared experience.
What's going on for girls and gender diverse youth in this back to school season? And how can we support their well-being and mental health? I'm Andrea Gunrach from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. When I worked with young people a few years ago, they told me that the back-to-school season was a time of anxiety and excitement. As September approaches this year, I wonder how back-to-school feels for them now. The last few years have been challenging for everyone, but girls and gender-diverse young people have had it especially tough. In Canada, 20 to 25% of young people deal with at least one mental health disorder. Young people aged 12 to 17 said their mental health has declined since 2015, and the decline has been more pronounced amongst young women. On top of that, children and youth who are recent immigrants or refugees, racialized, or in rural and remote communities are less likely to receive appropriate mental health care. Think social media pressures, hypersexualization, stereotyping, toxic masculinity, bullying, fear of rising abuse and harassment, climate anxiety, and generally feeling left behind. The list of what girls and gender diverse young people face today is intense. And as of late, young people have had a lot of interruptions at a sensitive developmental age, especially girls and gender diverse young people with fewer resources. Their mental health and well-being, as well as their sense of connection, belonging, and confidence, have been shaken. Their healthy relationship skill development opportunities have taken a hit, too. How can caring adults in the lives of girls and young people smooth the transition back to school, whether they be a parent, guardian, teacher, coach, auntie, uncle, or neighbor? How can we support improved mental health, confidence, and healthy relationships? Taylor Meisner joins us today to talk about it. She's a registered social worker with a Master of Social Work from the University of Toronto. She's also a disability coordinator and learning strategist at Carleton University. She provides counseling in private practice at Intersections Collective, mainly working with 2S LGBTQ plus youth and adults. Outside of her employment, you can find her community organizing, reading a book from the library, spoiling her Rottweiler, or swimming.
I'm definitely adventurous. I went on a road trip to Nova Scotia to visit my oldest friend. We didn't realize that there was a major flood until afterwards. So I was driving down the highway and hydroplaned, but I was thinking, you know, in Nova Scotia, they're used to these types of storms, right? I just need to pull over, ground myself for a moment, and then come back on, turn my four ways on, make sure that I am visible. It wasn't until after I returned home and my dad was freaking out that I realized that there was actually a giant flood. I'm really grateful that I was okay, and my heart goes out to the Nova Scotians who were affected. Being in road trips, going surfing, all those things appeal to me.
We've seen so many articles about worsening youth mental health. What's the situation you see in your work? And girls and gender-diverse young people, what's happening for them in particular?
First of all, I don't want to concern listeners out there because my job is to provide support for the people who are needing it. I do work in an office for students with disabilities who reach out when they need support. And I've also worked in community mental health, supporting parents, families, youth, and individuals through the pandemic. What I will say are there are more people reaching out for support. We're having higher numbers of registration in our disabilities office. The most common disability categories are mental health and ADHD, attention deficit / hyperactivity disorder. Generally, working in both community mental health and in private practice, there's an increase in people seeking counseling, psychotherapy support. The COVID-19 pandemic, the health anxiety, the lockdowns and isolation associated with it has a lot of people feeling a bit behind in things like social skills and academics. We're all in this together. I know we all have different experiences and we have different experiences of being in this together. But in terms of feeling like there was some time where we weren't attending classes or we weren't seeing people, a lot of people have that as a shared experience. You know, looking at the way that social media and AI have evolved so rapidly, there's a lot of change in a short period of time. Being able to have that media literacy to see what's real, what's being done to create a better image of oneself. I think that can really affect body image of women, girls, and gender diverse, trans, non-binary youth. Trans youth who I worked with in the pandemic. We had a group in the community called Transcending Isolation, which I know is a bit corny, but I love the puns. When we first started the group, it was really difficult for people to come on camera and use mics due to experiences of gender dysphoria. We addressed that by doing a lot of art, like a lot of people would show off their art. The ability to come into the space, be on camera, use the mic for folks who have been marginalized, it's a lot harder. So I think even that consideration is important. On the other hand, having access to virtual supports has been really valuable for people with disabilities, right? That has created so much access. So there's a lot of things to consider. I work in the disability field. So looking at different manifestations of disability, like under diagnosis of ADHD or autism, due to the way that people have been socialized or the way that symptoms might present differently. Definitely being mindful of how people appear differently in the world, how comfortable people feel taking up space, and also how people are affected by media perceptions. All those things are huge.
What are key considerations going to be for girls and gender diverse young people as they go back to school this fall?
Want to reach out and speak just like I would speak to a student and say, you are not behind, you're not socially awkward. Everyone is in the same boat. I think a lot of people stress about this, but what you can do is recognize the value and power in your strengths. Maybe you need to talk to someone to see, you know, what are my strengths? What do other people see in me? Parents, guardians, teachers, role models, those people can be really great at hyping the youth up, right? That's so important. Find safe people, people you trust, find safe places. Where do you like to be in school? You know, do you like to spend time outside? Do you like to be part of a club? Go where your whole self is embraced, or you can do the things that you want to do. You know, if you notice there are some things that are difficult for you, if you asked for help, you deserve to receive it. Again, these trusted people, they're there to support you, and you deserve that support, even though it can be a difficult process asking for help for some time.
So here's a question directly from a member of the Canadian Women's Foundation's community. How is echo anxiety affecting young people, especially girls of color?
Even the anecdote I told at the beginning of this podcast tied into major climate events, which I mean, I don't know about you, but here in unceded Algonquin territory where I'm living right now, we are seeing a tornado warning or an Environment Canada warning just about every week. So it's a really relevant issue. And I see for youth and especially youth of color, a lot of really righteous, well-founded anger, sadness, and concern, because there's this idea that it's people misusing their power and people looking the other way that are creating or exacerbating these climate situations. I actually had a conversation with a student yesterday, and she was in a human rights class, and she's a young woman of color, and she was saying that, you know, one of her classmates was talking about how the West needs to help out other countries, and she pointed out, well, if it weren't for imperialism and colonialism, we might not be in this situation. And she spoke out, and she actually made a friend in the class because she spoke out, and they were able to connect and work together on the academic assignment and, you know, otherwise connect using your voice. So important. And for me to help with my eco-anxiety, I really look to the work of Adrienne Marie Brown, Emergent Strategy. So how the interactions that we have every day, we're able to create rippling patterns. Do what you can, even if it feels overwhelming.
Here's another great community question. What role does media play in influencing mental health of girls and teens? Can media be leveraged to actually improve well-being?
We know media representation is so important because if you can see it, you can be it. Tangible examples of women, queer people, trans, non-binary people in power is so important. I just, it's a lot to unpack, but I just came out of the Barbie movie, right? Where women are astronauts, women are presidents, and I won't go into that more, but we know it's important. It's established that this is super important. In terms of how we can leverage it to positively improve people's well-being. First of all, the media literacy piece, being able to pick up on context clues, being able to think critically and see, okay, is this real or is this fake? Who is the intended audience for this? What is the intended message of this media? How is it trying to influence us? Being able to know that is super important as background. You know, seeking out media representation that isn't just one body that's, you know, never going to be my body. So I like the body is not an apology. I think that's a really good resource. Even just looking up tags of different kinds of representation, like trans representation, you know, body positive, fat representation, all kinds of Black, Brown, Indigenous women out there. And then also creating your own media, right? Like doing a photo shoot with your friends, creating your own work, even if it's not going to be published widely, even if you're not ready to share it with the world, just taking those pictures for yourself is so valuable.
What can everyday people do to make things better for young people in their lives? Parents and guardians, peers, significant adults?
This ties into, again, ADHD disability perspectives, which is really doing things with young people. It's one thing to tell someone how to do something. It's very different to do a hands-on experience, whether it's cooking, whether it is home repair, whether it is learning any kind of new skill. Doing that hands-on with somebody is so valuable. Even more generally, taking time to connect, making those offers of connection. You know, sometimes teenagers want to do their own thing, and that can be hard too. Just remember that's developmentally appropriate. You know, it's not personal. And just generally knowing that you're a safe person to talk to, right? So, you know, if you're worried about your teen doing substances or being out late, you know, it's one thing to want to lecture them, which is totally understandable. But it's another thing to say, hey, if you're ever really in trouble, you can give me a call, because that way, you know, if something did come up, the support is there.
Time for another question from a member of our community. What are early warning signs of mental health issues in girls and teens? How can we ensure early intervention?
With mental health, it's sometimes hard to find what the baseline is, right? It's hard to give general warning signs about your teen being withdrawn or your teen not enjoying things that they used to enjoy. Teens are changing at a very fast rate. Everybody's baseline is different, right? So, you know, if you're going through some difficulties in your family, just like we're going through many difficulties in society with things like cost of living, with the after effects of COVID-19, with climate change, you know, there's a lot going on. If you connect with your teen regularly and you notice changes, like you notice isolation when there wasn't isolation before, when you notice grades slipping when grades were high before, when you notice that they've totally given up on a hobby, letting them know that you're a safe person to talk to, that you are there to support, and that you won't judge them. That's really crucial if you notice those changes.
I think a young person from our community asked this one. How do I deal with society's perception of what's beautiful so I feel confident about how I look?
I always encourage young people to question, you know, who benefits from that? Are people making money off my diet? Are people making money off me trying to fix parts of myself? Who loves me unconditionally? Who is going to hype me up? How can I spend more time with them or in those online communities? Take care of yourself. Admire yourself. What do I like about myself? What do I want to emphasize about myself? How can I seek out representation of folks who look like me, who I love their look? We might not be able to be totally confident in ourselves right away, but maybe there's people from our communities where we're like, they're killing it.
All right. Now what? Our guest Taylor recommends you check out youth mental health services and programs in your local area. For post-secondary students in Ontario and Nova Scotia, she says Good to Talk provides free, confidential hotline support. Go to goodtotalk.ca. She also notes that the LGBT Youth Line offers confidential youth peer support by telephone, text, and chat in Ontario. Go to youthline.ca. For more services that may be relevant to you, visit CanadianWomen.org. I'd also encourage you to give to the Canadian Women's Foundation this fall, as we're raising funds for girls and gender-diverse youth across Canada. Your gift goes directly to programs that bolster mental health, emotional well-being, and confidence, teach young people about healthy relationships and consent, provide cultural and community connection, offer mentorship, give participants opportunities to safely explore science, tech, and math, sports and physical activity, media literacy, and community leadership, and provide positive, inclusive spaces where girls and gender-diverse young people can thrive. Go to CanadianWomen.org to give now. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Time.
C. C is for
cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K for
kitten.
Cam.
See, wait. Fandrup. See. U. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
This idea of storytellers versus story takers, and that's something that, you know, I always try to keep in the back of my mind.
At a time of challenge and promise for gender justice, we need excellent feminist journalism. How do they do what they do best? I'm Andrea Gunrad from the Canadian Women's Foundation. Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. We put an intersectional feminist lens on stories that make you wonder, why is this still happening? We explore systemic roots and strategies for change that will move us closer to the goal of gender justice. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and our partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Métis, and Inuit territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations. Women and equity-seeking journalists investigate important and undertold stories. Whether they write articles, do podcasts, or create other digital media, we badly need them to give voice to gender justice matters that otherwise go unheard. Think about the most stunning contemporary stories you've seen on gendered impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic,
missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people, discrimination against Black women at work, gender pay gaps, sexual and reproductive health and rights, and more. Chances are that women and equity-seeking journalists were behind them. This fact makes the harassment and abuse they experience at disproportionate levels particularly vexing. It's harmful to them as people and media workers, and it runs counter to the goal of making things better and fairer in Canada. We can't achieve that goal without a diverse news media landscape and truth in reporting. Every year, the Canadian Women's Foundation presents the Landsberg Award in partnership with the Canadian Journalism Foundation to acknowledge and inspire feminist journalism. It's named after iconic journalist and author Michelle Landsberg. She was columnist for the Toronto Star, the Globe and Mail, and Chatelaine magazine, and is one of the first journalists in Canada to address workplace sexual harassment, racial discrimination in education and employment, and gender equality in the law. Journalist and activist Gloria Steinem said, "Those who make a revolution and those who write about it are usually two different people." Michelle Landsberg is one of the few on earth who is trusted and effective at both. Past winners of the Landsberg Award include such journalists as Connie Walker, Robin Doolittle, Christina Frangou, and more. Today we're joined by Molly Hayes, who won the 2023 Landsberg Award alongside Tavia Grant and Elizabeth Renzetti for their series on intimate partner violence and femicide in Canada. She is a national reporter with the Globe and Mail. She joined the Globe in 2017 as the inaugural recipient of the Canadian Journalism Foundation's Investigative Journalism Fellowship, and today reports on crime and social justice issues, including violence against women.
I went into journalism school straight from high school. I did a Bachelor of Journalism at TMU. So at that point, I don't have like a profound reason. I was a teenager and was good at English class, and it seemed like a job where I could get paid to write. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have a real great origin story there, but I think it was once I was in university and once I was sort of in it a little bit more that I started to appreciate the value of journalism and the power that it can hold. I think I was already doing it a little bit by the time that I really appreciated it and, you know, the responsibility that comes with that, and became interested in sort of focusing my career on issues of, you know, unfairness and corruption and oppression and things like that.
What did this award win mean for you? And tell us more about how you use a feminist and gender justice approach to your reporting.
You know, it was a huge honor to have this series recognized, especially to have that recognition alongside Liz and Tavia. They are both incredible mentors and colleagues and friends, and it's such a depressing topic, but an amazing team to work with on this. One of the big things, like in terms of a feminist lens, was that we didn't just want to write about the problem. We also wanted to make sure we focused on solutions, and specifically solutions that survivors themselves were pointing to. It would be easy to speak to the you know, the stakeholders in this arena and academics and things like that, but we wanted to hear right from women themselves, like what would have helped them when they were going through this. This was a multi-part series, and we made sure to dedicate an entire part at the end specifically to their voices in their own words and highlighting the things that they are calling for right now. So that was a big thing that we were conscious of sort of throughout this process, and we were particularly proud of.
So I guess by nature, you're reporting on things that can be pretty personal and tough from the voices of abuse survivors. What considerations do you think about when you're grappling with telling survivor stories in the right ways?
That was something we were very conscious of throughout this whole process and try to be all the time in our work. Duncan McHugh has talked about, and I'm paraphrasing a bit, but this idea of storytellers versus story takers. And that's something that, you know, I always try to keep in the back of my mind. Similarly, when we talk about giving a voice to the voiceless, that's something I think a lot of people hear early on in journalism training. And I think our perspective on that has started to shift. People are not voiceless. People don't have platforms. So we're not giving them voices. We're giving them megaphones. In some ways, approaching trauma-informed reporting runs counter to what we've been taught. You know, rules around like everything is on the record. You don't run anything by people before stories. Like, I think some of that is starting to shift, and we are finding ways without compromising, you know, journalistic integrity, of making sure that our subjects, especially vulnerable ones, have agency over their story and aren't surprised by what's in the paper. And, you know, don't feel like just because they reach out to you about possibly speaking, that that's going to end up in the paper. It's a bit more of a delicate approach, I guess. And it takes a bit of extra time, but I think it's worth it in the end. And we're lucky to, you know, be with a paper that is willing to take that time and sort of to make sure that we're doing it the right way.
How did your series on intimate partner violence come about? Was there anything that surprised you in your process of research and investigation?
I mean, we began this project in sort of the peak of COVID. And by that point, all three of us had been reporting on these issues for some time. We were very familiar with it. But I think there was sort of a moment during COVID where it was part of the broader public consciousness. This is something we were talking about a lot. We were seeing the rates of violence increase. There were a lot of warnings going out. And so we knew that this was something that people were talking about, but we weren't sure what the broader interest would be, because this wasn't necessarily something new. You know, we were diving into issues that have been there for a very long time. And we were very in the weeds of it and weren't sure, like, you know, what is this adding to the conversation? And I think that happens on any sort of long-term project. You know, you're so close to it, you don't know. But one of the things that surprised me was the level of response we got, especially to that first piece that looked at coercive control and sort of explained what that looks like and what the debate is around criminalizing it. But yeah, the response we got from the number of women who said, this describes what happened to me and I never had a word for it. It was both surprising, but also I think one of the things we're most proud of, we heard directly from people who said that this gave them the language to sort of understand and describe what they had gone through. And yeah, that was just very meaningful and rewarding to hear that.
Let's pause here. There's no question to me that we need a strong news media landscape, well-supported feminist journalism, and open digital access to news and information. But the biggest search and social media platforms are ending access to news before Bill C-18, the Online News Act, gets enforced in Canada. Gender implications are huge. Women in Canada use social media more than men. And diverse women, girls, and two-spirit, trans, and non-binary people rely on search and social media to get information about their unique health, safety, pay, and employment concerns. The underspoken, underaddressed issues of inequalities where we live, work, and play. There's a tech and time gap, too. Women are heavier social media users, but they have less time for the internet than men. Women's time is sucked up by higher care and housework responsibilities. And economic insecurity may mean that women and gender diverse people can't afford the latest devices and bandwidth. If we can't rely on the biggest social media sites and search engines to help us find news about our experiences, gender gaps will widen, especially for those of us dealing with social and geographic isolation, marginalization, and unsafety. So the journalism landscape in Canada is tough and only getting tougher, especially for journalists who cover stories like the ones you cover. What would you say to aspiring feminist journalists trying to break into the media these days?
Yeah, it is bleak. The landscape is bleak in many ways. But I also think we're sort of in a golden era for this reporting. You know, like, I was looking at the list of recent Landsberg winners, and like, what a list to be on. Christina Frangiou, Robin Doolittle, Connie Walker, Alicia Hasham, Wendy Gillis. Like, I worship all of those writers, and I know most of them, and they're very kind and generous people. So I think a big thing, especially for journalists who are starting out, seek out mentors and seek out the women who are doing this work. I know most of those people. People are generous. They want to help. They want to talk. So I think that's been a really helpful tool for me. And I also think it's important to remember that we don't have to just be chasing the hot new thing. Like, a lot of these especially these sort of seemingly intractable social issues, have been broken for a long time, and they are just as worthy of our focus, even when they're not sort of the night's top story. Head down, do the work, find the people that inspire you, I guess.
All right, now what? Go to CanadianWomen.org to read The Gender Gap in Digital News Access, which speaks to the gendered impact of digital news blockages in Canada today. In light of these challenges, it may be helpful to you to bookmark trusted, evidence-based news sites, subscribe to news curation and feminist podcasts like this one, and follow feminist reporters doing stories about your lived experiences. These are not perfect solutions to our systemic digital concerns, but they may be helpful to you. Please listen, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. If you appreciate this content, please consider becoming a monthly donor to the Canadian Women's Foundation. People like you will make the goal of gender justice a reality. Visit CanadianWomen.org to give today, and thank you for
what you gonna do now?
The million endless solitary nights of my life.
This is DJ Shadow, and you're tuned into 90.3 FM, CKUT, Montreal.
Welcome to All Right, Now What, a podcast from the Canadian Women's Foundation. In this season, we're investigating gender-based violence in these times of pandemic crisis. And I'm your host for this episode, Kate Hawkins. Last week, you heard from my colleague and co-host, Andrea Gunraj, in conversation about the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence and all the ways you can act together to create change on this really pressing issue. The 16 days is ongoing, so I'd encourage you to check out our website, CanadianWomen.org, for a bit more info about how you can get involved. And this week, I had the chance to speak with Anuradha Dugal, who is the first voice you'll hear. She's our Senior Director of Community Initiatives and Policy at the Foundation. And she's joined by Jacqueline Hall, who is the Program Manager at the Foundation, working on a Rebuilding Lives and Girls Fund Grants Dreams. So welcome to you both. Today, we're talking about emotional abuse, as you know. And I think in the context of the pandemic, we at the Foundation have been speaking a lot about the increased risk of violence, which I think is interpreted mostly as physical. But there's this whole other element that I think we need to be conscious of about as people are sort of increasingly isolated. So to start, maybe if you could tell me a bit about what emotional abuse is and the forms it can take so we can be a little bit more aware of it.
Yeah, I think there's levels of manipulation and control that are often seen as emotional or psychological in the ways that abusers use that or use those forms of control are often quite sneaky. They generally are centered around trying to make the abused a partner feels smaller. And in a context of a pandemic, it might be around whether they're taking care of the children sufficiently, whether they're keeping themselves and the home adequately safe and clean. And also, on the other hand, the use of threats is also very common. So there's a sort of coercive control to say, you must do things my way, but it's bolstered by the threat of being left on their own, being pushed out of a home in the context of a pandemic, when it is probably way more unsafe for women, or women feel less safe out in the world.
And I guess the second part of that question is, how is this experienced differently for different women, for women who might already be in a precarious position, for gender diverse folks?
Being discouraged from having contacts with people outside of the home, isolating people in that way, is perhaps much harder for women who are already isolated, say because of their immigration status or because of language barriers. Those kinds of forms of control can be much more serious. Jackie, I'm also very conscious that you've been working with Indigenous families in some of the work we've been doing. And of course, Indigenous communities have horrific histories with colonization and illness and disease that make this time much, much more dangerous and much, much more threatening.
You know, communities like Indigenous communities, especially those that are sort of more removed from urban centers, you know, we start talking about, you know, access to services, lack of access to infrastructure, et cetera. And so implications become a lot more acute. The ability to seek support and service becomes significantly more challenging. And in the context of colonization, the ability to access appropriate, culturally safe services is significant. And I think what we've seen in the media a lot lately would also, you know, bring up sort of the idea of gaslighting as a form of abuse, where we see that, you know, in the cases where women do seek support, that they are often blamed and made to feel that it is their own fault, that their own that they have somehow contributed to the abuse, and really questioning whether that abuse is even real.
We've been having conversations internally about emotional abuse at the foundation, and most recently we are hosting this book club. It's called the Tireless Readers Collective, and as part of that conversation we got the chance to speak with Eternity Martis, who wrote they said this would be fun, race, campus life, and growing up. And in her book, she talks a lot about how we can focus on gender-based violence or intimate partner violence in long-term adult relationships and sort of lose focus about what it might look like in dating relationships and relationships for young people. So I'm wondering if you can speak a bit to that. Like, how does emotional abuse play out uniquely in dating relationships and maybe with teens?
Yeah, absolutely. So gaslighting, and as a term, I know is probably common speak for those of us that are sort of in this sector, in this world, perhaps less so for folks not so involved. Gaslighting ultimately is defined as a form of emotional abuse where the person who is indicating that they have had an experience being made to feel that experience is not real. It is imagined. It is in their head. And even if it was to be true, that it is of their own making. And so it is intended to leave the person who is suffering the abuse to question their own interpretation of what is happening, to question their own judgment, to question their role in a situation, and to be, and ultimately to build empathy for their abusers, and minimize their contribution to the situation. So, it's a tactic often used by emotional abusers, or frankly, even those who perpetuate physical, sexual, or other forms of abuse. It is used as a tactic to have have the person at the receiving end really not be able to speak up about what is happening, to challenge what is happening, and to just reinforce the intended power dynamic over that person.
I think you're getting at this a little bit in talking about the teen healthy relationships programming, but I guess if we're to move to solutions, you know, what's happening at the grassroots level to address emotional violence in Canada? And what sort of solutions are we supporting at the foundation?
In the teen programs, one of the things they talk about very often is emotional abuse or emotional manipulation in the form of, say, jealousy or the use of different kinds of ways to guilt a partner into doing what you want. So, for example, I think for young people, it's quite common to feel that if a partner is jealous about somebody you're seeing or wants to know where you are or is checking up on you, it's a sign of care and concern. and love and maybe even, you know, fascination. And it can be very flattering, especially when you have maybe a little bit less experience, or when you're in the first stages of a relationship, it seems to make the relationship burn hot and very, very exciting. And I think that's one of the flags that very often when dating programs with teens are happening, it's one of the things they discuss, and they try and discuss the difference between care and concern and making sure somebody's okay over what might be considered much more abusive use of sort of surveillance. And so they do, those programs, I think, spend a lot of time trying to unpack those emotions and also trying to learn healthy ways of communicating and having boundaries and then being able to express what's going on for you without increasing levels of threat or guilt or using emotional manipulation.
I'll leave it to Anu to maybe talk more about policy related to the National Action Plan on Gender-Based Violence and others. But the foundation is clearly focused on addressing these issues from a variety of touch points, whether that's funding for programs, policy, and doing a lot of public awareness through social media, the Signal for Help campaign and other things that provide entry points for folks to get more information, learn more about how to recognize abuse and what to do or how to get support when that is their experience.
Mm. Yeah, the National Action Plan on Violence Against Women and Girls and Gender-Based Violence is a really important piece of legislation that we are have been working with the federal government on for several years now. And there's been a reissued call as well as a reissued promise from the federal government in the Speech from the Throne that this will be the focus, and that within the next 12 months we'll see a national action plan, which means a plan that includes the provinces and the territories and finds the mechanisms by which women can access, or those who have been abused can access, similar levels of service so that they can redress the violence they're experiencing wherever they are in the country. So knowing that, just as Jackie mentioned earlier on, there are particular barriers for First Nations, Inuit and Métis women, depending on where they are in the country. And just as an example, the number of shelters that are available on reserve and off reserve for different Indigenous women's groups is very, very limited when you compare it to other levels of shelters, as well as the level of funding those shelters receive. These are systemic barriers that have been in place for a number of years that the National Action Plan really seeks to recognize and then address in a way that will bring more equity.
For sure, yeah. I guess taking it back to sort of the individual level, what can someone do if they're experiencing this kind of abuse? Or if they could maybe recognize these red flags we've been discussing with a friend or with a family member?
Well, I think education is the first step. So to learn about what emotional abuse looks like and to do some reading, do some background reading on that, and be able to notice what controlling behavior looks like. And then I would just always, in the safest way possible, safe for you as a friend or a family member, as well as safe for the person you're reaching out to, just pay attention, ask some questions, ask some open-ended questions, so you're not going to direct the conversation in a particular direction. Are you doing okay? I haven't heard from you for a while. Is everything all right? I'm always here for you. I'd love to hear what's going on. You just need to be open to listening in a non-judgmental way. And very often, although those
those questions that you ask may be answered in very simple ways, to keep on asking them. If you're concerned, keep on asking them. Again, not in a judgmental way, not in a threatening way, but in a way that lets somebody know that you'll always be there for them. And at some point, if this sort of abuse is happening, then that person will come through and they'll know that you've been there for them. And you will, as a family member or as a friend, you will be able to step in at a point that is appropriate for the person you're reaching out to.
Mm-hmm. So on the note of taking action, we're releasing this season of the podcast during the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. And during this time, especially as we sort of head into what will likely be a really isolating holiday season for so many of us, we're calling on people to take action on gender-based violence through our Act Together campaign. And we've partnered with The Body Shop, and we've got sort of this calendar of stuff you can do every day for 16 days to end gender-based violence. But I'm wondering, what's one thing that you both hope everyone does to act together during this time and beyond? Because we know that this problem is deeper than this moment.
Mm. It's interesting, simply from the standpoint, so I live in Montreal, I sit in Montreal, I work in Montreal. There's no question that December 6th here is an important date that is commemorated and often remembered by wide swaths of the population. It's also the province where we have a premier that does not acknowledge systemic racism exists. And in 2020, we've seen movements to address systemic racism and violence by the state. And I think it's for me, the thing I would like to see is that wider discussion, especially since in this podcast we're talking about emotional abuse, to have folks think about how state violence is perpetrated against Indigenous, Black, and other racialized communities. And often the kinds of talking points that leadership have in this country that make it so that these communities are gaslighted, essentially, or told that what is being experienced is somehow, an individual bad at the hands of an individual bad actor, that it is not systemic, that it is not wider reaching. And I think after seeing incidents such as Joyce Eshequan dying at the hands of her healthcare providers in a hospital, or Breonna Taylor being shot in her own home in Kentucky, and the subsequent conversations about how those kinds of situations happen and keep happening, I think we're at an opportune time to start making those linkages between systemic violence, gender-based violence, and racial violence. And if people are confined to their homes, it's a good time to start doing some reading. As you mentioned, Kate, we have a Tireless Readers Collective. There are lots of recommendations coming out of that group for some easy reading to start with. But there's no shortage of resources for people to be reading up on and learning about the relationship between state violence, racial violence, and gender-based violence.
For sure. And I would say if you're looking for particular things to read, watch, sign, participate in, you can check out that calendar that I mentioned. That's on our website.
I wholly support everything that Jackie just said. I think it's a great, it's absolutely where the conversation is around different forms of violence across throughout different parts of Canada right now. I guess to maybe bring it down to an individual level, if people are interested, there are multiple groups, conversation groups, protest groups, and they're happening at a community level, which has not really, I haven't seen for a number of years now, pods that you can join that will encourage discussion and sharing of materials, as well as actual socially distant gatherings where you can, you know, fully masked, fully, within distant from each other, but at the same time gaining a sense of being with a community that is responding to the levels of police violence that Jackie mentioned. And I think understanding solidarity at a time like this is very, very important. And so we are very much, as people have said, right, already, we're in this together, but we're experiencing it very, very differently. And if you don't take the time to learn how those experiences are different right now, where there's ample opportunity, and I think a lot of people very open to having those conversations, it would be a missed opportunity. So I would say this is a time to maybe step out a little bit of your typical groups and try and find maybe new groups to be to work in solidarity with. But I would just really recommend that people keep moving forward with hope that there's lots of potential for change here that we've already seen, and to find your source of hope as you move forward.
Thanks for listening to this episode of All Right, Now What? If you'd like to learn more about us, you can go to canadianwomen.org/podcast. And if you have questions or comments about the show, we would definitely love your feedback, and we can be reached at engagement@canadianwomen.org. Until next time.
To say my being is pressed into trying to remember something, and I can't listen, so it's not telling me, or this is my story, and maybe the day I'm gonna die, maybe gonna come back, and I'm si j'arrive à écouter dans mes oreilles. ce que je dis. Je suis en train de... If I can listen in my ears to what I say. I can't remember. But there is a sensation of having died already. Diagonal in the world, so I can't face reality really. When I face reality really, I feel that death is not so far, and that everything I do for my own good is a preparation for that moment. Could I look at you in your eyes and actually listen to what I say, really? Like right now, I'm saying nothing, but it's just like I'm talking, because if I stop talking, I feel like my energy is going to collapse again, and I want to remember. I want to remember, and I somehow I'm convinced that before I'm gonna die, I'm gonna lose my memory just like my mom. Today I walked in Prospect Cemetery and I saw a grave, and there was this name of Claudia, Kathleen Claudia Robinson and Claude P. Robinson, like both my names on the same grave, and no, nobody with those names here in Canada. This because this feels like it might be interesting. Samuel Beckett wrote the trilogy, and in L'Innommable, he's trying to have an internal voice shut up. So he's writing until the voice will shut up and catch. Thank you.
afternoon. You're tuned to Butcher T's Noontime Cuts, hitting every Friday from noon to 2, playing your wide variety of music just to make your afternoon delight just right. So stay locked at the CKT 90.3 FM.